The Government Operations Subcommittee will now come to order. Brenda, please call the roll. Here.
Chair Fisher.
Here.
Representatives Barrero. Chambliss.
Here.
Fabricio. Fetterhoff.
Here.
Hinson.
Here.
Jenny.
Here.
Killebrew.
Yes, ma'am.
McClure.
Here.
McCurdy.
Here.
Rizzo.
Here.
Rodriguez, excused. Roth.
Here.
Sabatini, excused. Schoaf. Skidmore.
Here.
Smith.
Here.
Zika.
Present.
We have a quorum, Chair.
Thank you, Brenda. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum. We will make sure that Representative Barrero and Fabricio are marked as present. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. In the absence of, I want to welcome the new committee, new members to the committee. I know I sent everybody a letter and reached out to them, but I want to welcome everybody that's new to the committee. We did a lot of great work last year, and we're glad to have you as part of the team. Since our vice chair is not here today, I've unofficially designated Representative Fetterhoff as my unofficial vice chair, should I need to leave. I don't think I will, but we want to make sure that we always have a contingency in place. As far as electronic devices, please make sure all your cell phones and communication devices, laptops, are turned off or placed in silent mode. For today's meeting, the Department of Management Services will provide an update on the implementation of House Bill 1391 from 2020 and from House Bill 217 from House Bill 1297 from 2021. As a reminder, House Bill 1391 established the Florida Digital Service with the Department of Management Services and sought to modernize state government information technology by requiring the establishment of an enterprise architecture and data catalog. House Bill 1297 expanded upon the streamlined state cybersecurity policies and practices. After the presentation, I'll recognize a few members for questions. With that, I want to welcome Chief Financial Officer Jamie Grant, former representative. It's always good to have you here in the Florida House, and happy belated birthday.
I show on.
There we go.
Good to be back with you. Thank you. I don't recognize this committee room anymore. Y'all have done quite an upgrade. It looks good. It's good to be with y'all this afternoon or this morning. I appreciate the opportunity. I think the chair very eloquently laid out kind of the objective of what we were asked to come present on. And so my intention would be to give you kind of a high level overview and obviously take any questions that you have on the subject matter. So just to give a quick update on 1391, as Chair Fisher mentioned, was a bill a couple of years ago that looked to reform the purpose of what state technology does. For those of you that were on the committee last year, I think you remember Joanne Lesnoff, who knows more about this stuff than I think a lot of us will, she can forget more than a lot of us will know, kind of presented the history. The Florida Digital Service is intended to be kind of a lean and agile organization focused on modernizing state government and the way we look at services provided. And so 1391 really had three kind of main high-level components. The chair touched on them. It created the digital service, so that reformed what was previously the Division of State Technology, restructured some things, gave a different mission, and established the Florida Digital Service. It required the creation of an enterprise architecture intended to promote interoperability across state government, change the way we buy and manage state technology, and then lastly required the creation of a data catalog and a data dictionary. I'll touch on a couple of those things as we move. First, just to kind of explain the structure of the digital service as the Division for State Technology was abolished and the digital service was created. There are really five components to the digital service. There's the Office of Data Management that will be led by a chief data officer. They are really in the business of two things right now. Those two things are the data catalog and then automation as a service. That was something the legislature funded last year. And so we are working with agencies, having established a number of use cases, receiving submissions from those agencies. They actually come to us and ask for us to sponsor automation projects. And so those are the two things that the Data Management Office is involved in. You have the Office of Information Security. So that would be led by a state CISO. They really do two things, incident management and then operations. A large portion of their year has been taken up by incident response. They also have to do the work on a subject matter expertise basis to actually present the legislature with the information necessary to draw down the funds that were appropriated last year to establish Florida's first cybersecurity program. I'm happy to report that's going very, very well. It is quite a process to lay out all of the different project planning components on that front, but incredibly proud of the work that team's done. The third team in the middle of the org chart, and actually the first thing you'd walk into if you visited our office, is the Office of Service Experience. That is a rebranded bureau. For those of you who are familiar with a project management office or a strategic planning office, the Division of State Technology had kind of mashed those up in a way that I don't think made a ton of sense. And so we created Service Experience, which is intended to be all of the project design, project management, project oversight to route people either outside the agency or inside the agency to the right place to find what they need to get solutions to what they're looking for. Policy implementation is the fourth component. Policy implementation I like to think of as kind of a think tank that governs. We have immense rulemaking responsibilities that range from the enterprise architecture, as we talked about, but project oversight on technology projects, cybersecurity, cloud first, and the like. And so that team is doing nothing other than rulemaking. And then they're having to do a ton of budget work to coordinate and navigate some of the challenges budgetarily that we've inherited. And then lastly, the infrastructure team. Right now they do two things. They run a state data center as we process the transition of a state data center. For those of you who are paying attention to that issue, last year the legislature appropriated some money and actually authorized the movement to outsource the state data center. It's the last standing state data center. The transition of that to a private sector managed service provider is underway. So that team is largely doing that. When they get done with that transition, they would move into infrastructure resiliency, cloud-first type migration programs to support agencies who are currently perhaps running on some antiquated infrastructure or have an opportunity to modernize. The last thing to touch on when we talk about the establishment of the digital service, and this is one thing that I often joke with people, if I knew now what I knew then, I could have perhaps been a more efficient legislator. Director Moskovitz and I sharing a building would often joke about the lessons you learn on the agency side. But just to give y'all kind of an understanding of where we were, where we are, and then where we would ultimately head, 91% of the appropriations came into the state data center budget entity when I was appointed, meaning the two budget entities that make up the Florida Digital Service, one runs a data center, the other does cybersecurity, data management, all of those other components. 91% of the appropriation was going to the operation of the state data center. 82% of the FTEs, the full-time equivalents, were in the state data center. That budget entity, because of federal funding, has a whole lot of restrictions on it. And so you may say, why wouldn't you use those employees to do things on the other side? It would actually jeopardize federal funding if those employees or those appropriations were not actually working on the state data center. The Office of the State CIO is the other budget entity. The other budget entity does cybersecurity, data management, project oversight, all of those things I talked about. When I was appointed, 9% of the appropriations went into that budget entity, and 18% of the FTEs were inside of that budget entity. You'll notice a little bit of a shift this year in the appropriation. The cybersecurity funding that you appropriated to reserve for us to draw down on is really the difference between the appropriation volume, but you'll notice the number of employees really haven't changed, right? So from 82% to 78%, a large number of the employees that are in the state data center would actually be offered positions through the outsourcing. So it's not like those folks just lose a job and go away, but those FTEs cannot do some of the things that y'all often ask us about, from cybersecurity, interoperability, those kind of things. Shifting to the enterprise architecture, the second component of 1391, kind of a large component. We kind of touched on it, and the chair gave a little bit of an introduction, but the enterprise architecture is intended to be a foundation that creates interoperability across state government. It's been an interesting exercise for our team. It's been organization-wide to make sure we accommodate every component of it. Very intentionally, version one of the enterprise architecture, what I gave the charge to the team and setting the framework was that it had to be industry agnostic, it had to be technology agnostic. We couldn't allow a single agency to stand up and say, yeah, but CGIS data is different, or HIPAA data is different, or FERPA or DIPA or any of the other restrictions that we have. And so last week we had the second workshop on the enterprise architecture. We're currently in the rulemaking process. You can, we're happy to provide it. It's obviously public, but you can see what we've proposed. We're currently in the comment period. That'll wrap Friday. And so we will be reviewing those comments and making changes as appropriate. One thing I would stress to y'all as kind of an objective out of the enterprise architecture is really trying to get away from kind of process measurement and getting into deliverables measurement. Right now in the state of Florida, an agency can spend a lot of money buying technology and never load test an application to tell you or me how many transactions a second before it's crippled. They never have to do a penetration test. They never have to identify different elements on the security within the security domain. And so we really tried to take a holistic look at it ground up and say, what are the baseline deliverables that any of us would expect in the private sector if we were running a company or if we were hiring somebody to do this work for us? And so the enterprise architecture carries with it a series of deliverables that run the life cycle, starts at the very beginning with the strategic planning and goes all the way through testing to require that before an agency puts something live, they actually document testing and make sure that what they're working on will in fact work for the Floridians we serve. And so that second rule workshop was last week. As I mentioned, we will close comment period on Friday. We will be looking to move as quickly as we can, but certainly want to make sure that we take those comments very, very seriously. The third component of 1391 is the data catalog and data dictionary. One of the challenges here, and I would tell you that when I said yes to this appointment, I knew what I was getting into in some regards. I thought I knew what I was getting into in other regards, and then I had no idea in yet some other spaces. One of the things I knew is that we inherited a brand that had a tremendous opportunity to improve. If you've paid any attention to the history of state technology, there's always been kind of an adversarial relationship between what is now the digital service or predecessors and some of the agencies. And sometimes that's because the agencies may not want to elevate their standards. And other times that might be a cultural issue with the technology office that thinks it can rule with an iron fist. The data catalog is something that we've worked very hard with agencies to kind of meet them where they are. We obviously have requirements and statute to deploy it. We are dependent on agency cooperation here. And so what we decided to do was to kind of launch in cohorts. And so as we sit here today, there are 11 agencies that have currently actively participated in the data catalog initiative. There are 500 databases that have been identified by the solution we've deployed. There are 2.9 data elements that have been identified, and there are 125 completed data sets that actually define what that data element is. This is not to pick on the Department of Health, but to give you one example, the Department of Health has actually been an agency that opted in very early and has been a fantastic partner. We have identified at least 50 different descriptions for a date of birth within just the Department of Health. Origination date, DOB, date of birth, birth date. Think of all the different things you could describe what my birthday is or what your birthday is. And so we will continue onboarding cohorts. One of the things that delayed us a little bit, and we were able to finally get some clarification earlier this month from General Counsel's office, Florida Statute 282.318 carries some pretty significant protections for information relating to cybersecurity. I would stress to y'all that is a very important thing because if this information was made public, it's legitimately a treasure map, right, of where different elements are within state government. And so we actually published a letter to state agencies assuring them that if a public records request were to come in, that 282.318 would be abided by and that their information would not be released by DMS. That kind of wraps high level on 1391 from a couple years ago and transitions us into House Bill 1297 from last year. Again, kind of giving you a parallel high level overviews for what 1297 looked at. It designated the digital service as the lead entity for cybersecurity. Puts a lot of responsibility on us to create a framework and a program for the first time in our state history to actually run cybersecurity like a state that's the third largest state in the country or a $105 billion enterprise deserves. And so we've been trying to prop that up from the beginning. Main three main components there: assessing risks within agencies, determining appropriate risk mitigation measures, and then developing standards and governance to try and elevate the behavior of agencies and the posture of the state, kind of starting with ourselves, right? So keeping in mind that when we run a state data center, one of our rules is that we eat our own dog food and we go first. And so if we're going to implement reforms, we do it on ourselves first. And so we've been working down that path. 1297 also made it clear that we're responsible for designating a state CISO, a Chief Information Security Officer. It creates the Florida Cybersecurity Advisory Council. Really excited that yesterday we saw some appointments made, so I think you'll see some traction there if you have not seen that. But yesterday afternoon, Governor DeSantis appointed seven members to that advisory council. That advisory council, for those of you who don't recall, is actually a continuation of a task force that was in place when I was appointed. And for those of you I had the opportunity to serve with, I think you know how I feel about task force in general. I was shocked to find how valuable this task force was. And so the advisory council is really intended to be a conduit to the private sector, really senior leadership, to have executive-level leadership from state government and executive-level leadership in the private sector to talk about best practices and ways that we can make the state better. And so that council, I expect to deliver some significant value in the way of policy and recommendations. And then the Cybersecurity Operations Center, we effectively call it the CSOC just because there are plenty of SOCs throughout government. But that operations center should be that operations center should be kind of the home of cybersecurity for the state, serving agencies and potentially even serving local governments with policy changes that are doable. And then lastly, cybersecurity training. We currently provide cybersecurity training in the way of maybe some classes you've taken and those kind of things. I would suggest to you that there's a big difference between a video you watch and a quiz you take and an actual cyber range where we can run simulated exercises with agencies to assess the skills, the talent, and hopefully make us a stronger state in that regard. Diving in a little bit to standardizing policies and giving you an update on a few things we're doing there. I mentioned the rulemaking responsibilities we have. 60GG2 of the Florida Administrative Code is cybersecurity. Like everything we inherited on the rule front, it is in need of some modernization. At least the cybersecurity rule has some standards up. I think you'll see it move really quickly post-enterprise architecture and post-project oversight rule reform into the cybersecurity rulemaking process, and we'll obviously keep you apprised of our actions there. We expect a notice of development of rulemaking in November of this year to kick off the rulemaking process for 60GG2. We are in the process of implementing a statewide strategic plan. That security plan is in draft. It's kind of in hold until we're able to deploy some of the initial tools once we're able to draw down on the money that is appropriated to reserve. And then creating Cyber Command was a kind of a subcomponent, but an emergency support function inside of DEM. So should emergency management of the future start to think about cyber resiliency as part of resiliency for the state? ESF20 was created in the legislation last year, working closely with our friends at emergency management, going through their rulemaking process, which is necessary to actually recognize us as ESF20. And then we're currently working on procedures and policies so that we can start running some dry fire and some tabletop exercises so that we know, you know, in the event that we do get deployed, how to explain to the folks on the floor who know nothing about cybersecurity and nothing about what we're doing, what to expect and why ESF20 is there. Supporting enterprise cybersecurity capabilities, designating a state CISO, so we are actively in the process of recruiting. I would tell you that one of the things that has been, you know, we talked about the tourist service model. Some of the budgetary challenges we've had this year have kind of made that a little bit more challenging. I think we're hopefully getting some clarity and on the backside of that where we can get back to recruiting. But looking at how we recruit talent, it can be a challenge in some of these situations where you're trying to find somebody that is talented, is willing to take a pay cut, and is willing to move to Tallahassee. Because for some of these C-level roles, it's just not, as we're standing up an organization, while I believe in telework and while I believe in giving people flexibility, launching a startup in government's pretty freaking hard. And so you need people that can be in the office to help you kind of get that set up. And so I'm excited to tell you that we have a lot of interest in working with us. Sometimes it's just a matter of making sure we can find that perfect storm of somebody who's willing to relocate to Tallahassee, somebody who's wanted to take in this space probably a 50% pay cut from what they'd make in the private sector, and then ultimately come in and do the work with little resources, right? And so I think the exciting thing and what I would stress to you from maybe encouragement for the direction the legislature has taken is that the policies in place, the actions you're taking, make my job recruiting a heck of a lot easier. It still gets us to that, you know, 2-yard line where we have to have those conversations of, look, this is just the brass tacks of what we can pay, and this is the reality of moving to Tallahassee. I like to explain to them, I've quite enjoyed living here over the last year, and it's not so bad. But we have a lot of interest. Once we can get back to the recruiting game, I think you'll see us build up pretty quickly. And then, as I mentioned, the Florida Cybersecurity Advisory Council. So that was kind of what we prepared, not to lecture you to death. I figured some of you had questions, and certainly would rather have a conversation or dialogue on things that that are directed where you'd like to take the conversation, and appreciate, Mr. Chairman and committee, the opportunity to be here today.
Great presentation, Jamie. Mr. Grant, I appreciate the presentation. I do have some questions, but I wanted to defer to the membership for their questions first. Since you were just on the state CISO officer, I do want to go ahead and ask about that. I know you said you were having some difficulty with that. Do you have you informally designated somebody? I mean, is the role still being done, right? I mean, I don't want anybody to walk away.
Yes, thank you. So thank you. Great clarification. I learned when I transitioned out of legislative world to agency world that there are three things necessary to hire somebody. You have to have the FTE on paper, which I knew. You have to have the salary and benefit, and then you have to have this mythical thing called rate. That's not the same thing as the operational function. And so we actually have the most talented security professional I've ever dealt with, hired or worked with otherwise, a guy named Brian Amadonza, who's done remarkable work in the face of a lot of challenges this year, who leads us technically. We have an Air Force veteran that came in to help operationally. So as we can hire up and build that team out from a budgetary perspective, but yes, that office is very much operational and working 8 hours or 8 days a week to kind of keep us afloat.
Awesome. Thank you. Representative Roth, you have a question?
Thank you, Chairman. And Mr. Grant, I really appreciate the in detail explanation. A lot of it went over my head, of course, so I'm going to ask a simple question. We think of it as legislators that we're really looking for government to continue to be more efficient, to be more transparent, to be able to work closer together. So could you talk about your challenges as you're dealing with cybersecurity and protecting the database and all that, but at the same time that agencies are able to communicate and share information and work together?
That's a great question, Mr. Chair. A couple things I'd say on that, just high level. A lot of people try and mystify cybersecurity. I like to think of it the same way as physical security. It starts with how you design. It starts with the vulnerabilities you create. It starts with assessing your vulnerabilities, looking at risk. It's really not that different than physical security. It's just a manner of applying digital tools, right? So understanding that it's a different landscape. So I think step one is understanding, and it's part of the reason we started with the enterprise architecture in addition to the focus there, is the fastest way to stop creating infinite vulnerabilities for the state is to buy and design better. If we start at the procurement phase, if we go all the way back to what we expect vendors to do for us and start there, that's where we make the most meaningful difference on cybersecurity first, kind of the stop the water from coming in the boat before we start bailing what's already in, right? So that's number one. Number two, I would tell you that changing cultures is hard. Establishing cultures is even harder. And one of the things in the cybersecurity space that I think we have to wrestle with as a state is figuring out the right alignment. I just put bluntly, one of the things I tell my team all the time is agencies need to quit seeing us as internal affairs and they need to see us as the cavalry. Sometimes the structure is hard, right? If you're an agency that we find suspicious activity and we come notify you and you do nothing about it, and then you end up having a real problem, you may not want to let our team in to have a conversation about what happened because we may discover that there was something that was problematic and we had warned. And so the structural alignment, I think, is something that is a challenge for us culturally sometimes to say, hey, we're really here to help. We promise. We're not here to play gotcha. But at the end of the day, Floridians' data should be treated really, really seriously. And if this suspicious activity is actually confirmed activity, we have a real problem and some real vulnerabilities. And so we've seen a wide array. You know, when online voting registration went down and we were deployed to help in the middle of the night, Secretary Lee looked at her team and said, anything they need, they get. And there's a reason that situation really went from national news to kind of a nothing burger in 24 hours. The teams worked really well collaboratively to say, hey, people should be able to register to vote. Let's get the situation fixed. We've had other situations where agencies haven't necessarily wanted to let us in to help. And so I've instructed our team to just make recommendations to make sure they understand what's there and to move. So I think as we earn all that, I would culminate by saying it's our job to earn the trust of the enterprise. Agencies need to trust us. And so I've told our team internally that we have a big culture to change where we've maybe acted like internal affairs historically. And we need to make sure that everybody understands that we're here to serve our customers and to support. And if we can establish that trust, we'll start to have, I think, more collaboration in some situations. And so I guess I would kind of culminate by saying we're still kind of in the infancy phase of establishing the culture, the processes internally while we manage projects externally. But I think the data catalog and some of those things actually set the foundation for us to be able to tell an agency, hey, if you've got a problem or you're trying to go on offense and make things more efficient between agencies, here's five ways we can help you. And so marching as kind of efficiently as we can. I think that the last thing on that is I'm really big in setting up organizations that we don't offer something we can't deliver on. And so given just some of the restraints in year one and some of the things we're trying to kind of push through, we're being a little bit deliberative not to get out there and promise the world and not be able to deliver on it.
Thank you. Representative Fabrizio, are you recognized for a question?
Thank you, Chair. And Mr. Grant, thank you so much for an excellent presentation. I'm new to this committee, and I think it brings me up to speed. In your presentation, you touched on the Cybersecurity Operations Center. Would you tell us a little bit more about what the status is? Is it operational? If not, when do you anticipate it being operational? Thank you.
Thank you. It's a great question. So the Cybersecurity Advisory, the CSOC is something that is one of the line items in Proviso. So the way that the cybersecurity funds were appropriated last year to reserve for us to draw down on through the budgetary amendment process actually lists that out. The current posture is that we can't draw down until we can lay out plans for everything. It's been kind of an interesting exercise. Number one, establishing an operational work plan, making sure that operational work plan is not public because there are a lot of things that would be in that operational work plan that would be a treasure trove for threat actors that seek to do us harm. Number two, and I'll give maybe the bad news first and the good news second. The bad news is, as an enterprise, we've never deployed governance or standards that give us any insight into what's out there, so to speak, on the landscape. The good news is we're so far behind, we're ahead. That when we can get year one set up and we can start doing endpoint identification and endpoint protection and an asset inventory and some of those early things, that discovery phase will lead to much better quantification. One of the things that our team's challenged with is just with a limited number of people having to do incident response and coordinate with the policy team on the operational work plan is not putting something in writing that makes us look laughable later. Because the discovery phase, we know what needs to be done. It's pitch black dark. We can turn on lights, like you mentioned, a SOC. So I would say we have a very, very informal SOC running that is a manual process with a team of about five. It's in no way sustainable or scalable. However, as we kind of finalize the budgetary process to get that budget amendment submitted so that we can actually go procure a managed SOC environment, I think that's where you get to what I think maybe you think of as a SOC.
Thank you so much.
All right. Ranking Member Chambliss, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. So I remember that when we switched over to the new system for the department that handles unemployment, that it's a brand new system. We had some concerns, brand new director, I think. Recently, I was informed that there might have been some security issues, cybersecurity issues just recently. So my question is, have those been resolved? Are we good there? And was there anything similar to that happening across other agencies?
You're recognized.
So it's a great question. first of all, I want to make sure that in a public forum, I'm answering your question and showing some restraint. Let me start at the high level to just kind of explain structure. Right now, and this is something that maybe we should have included in the slide, an agency CIO reports to their executive director or whoever else. Could be the chief of staff in an agency, but they report up through the agency it is. So economic opportunity in that example. While we have a very good relationship, and Ed Wynn, the CIO over there, has been a fantastic partner, Ed really reports up through a chain of command at DEO. The same thing is true of information security managers. So when you ask about a CISO, the information security managers report up usually through the CIO up through that agency. So that's kind of where I talk about trying to find the right collaboration and balance where they see us as an asset, even though they don't necessarily have to answer to us. In the economic opportunity situation, I would say that their team, there's a couple things. Some of by the time something makes news, right, it's kind of, especially in this space, typically been in existence for a long time. There's not a brand new system yet, right? So just to clarify that, that is underway. The legislature gave me the opportunity to sit in consult on the development of that new system, and so we're actively meeting with a group at DEO on that. I would tell you that maybe the best way I could answer the last half of your question is that in saying yes to this appointment and trying to think through how I allocate time between a really broad landscape, I say publicly and privately, I have an impossible job, and I love that. It's an impossible challenge every day, and it's just a matter of solving today's problems. I severely underestimated how much time we spend in the cybersecurity landscape and just how far behind we are as a state. The good news is we don't have a bunch of infrastructure to tear down. Right, we're not having to come in and criticize everybody's work in the cybersecurity space. I think that lets us move a little bit more quickly. But anybody who tells you we're in a great posture or that the state is hardened is giving you false hope. At the same time, anybody who says the state's not headed in the right direction doesn't know what they're talking about. We've made tremendous progress, and I think if we can continue collaboratively working between the executive branch and the legislative branch, and like I mentioned, even at the local level, I get calls from local governments all the time. I was on one last night, right? It's the only thing where home rule doesn't apply. The only thing where local government's calling and saying, please come help. And so I do think we are in the right direction. I think it's a matter of scaling and establishing and structuring what exists today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Guillermo Smith, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Grant, and welcome back. So you touched a little bit on, I guess, some of the departures that you've had. My understanding, unless you can correct me or just give us an update, is that you have about 180 some odd positions in your office. I've heard that a third of them are vacant. And from your cybersecurity team of 10, about half of those positions are vacant. I understand there's been a lot of high-level departures. One of the concerns I heard from you was it's hard to recruit folks to come work in Tallahassee. In particular, your chief information security officer, I think you've had three people in that role in the last year. One of them took a job, the same job with the city of Tallahassee. So I'm just wondering, are the vacancies in your agency, are they a concern to you? What other factors are leading to such a high vacancy rate within your team? And what can we do to help you? Is it as simple as just paying people more, giving them more incentives? What's going on there?
Yeah, so I think it's a great question. And I long ago learned that if the Tampa Bay Times told me there were 8 days in the week, I knew I should dig in, but obviously familiar with the reporting that you're talking about. I want to be very careful not to. I would say that there have been HR related answers to some of those questions. I would maybe simplify it by saying some turnover is very good and healthy turnover. Sometimes you give opportunities for people to resign and to move on. rather than protracting an HR event. I think, you know, kind of laughable about that reporting is that at no point did anybody try and identify how many hires have been made and the retention rates. 88% of all employees that we've brought in my tenure are still here. 100% of those who had been recruited by somebody at the department to come in are still here. And so it's unfortunate that some people try and make news salaciously without understanding or even attempting to understand. So I appreciate the question because I think the only thing worse than not having a conversation is having a misinformed having a misinformed conversation that just intentionally seeks to sow discord. And so there are absolutely some turnover that has happened. We have not had three CISOs, just to set the record straight.
Okay.
There was one when I got here, who is now at the city of Tallahassee, and that happened about 2 weeks into my tenure. We had a deputy that took the role, promoted as an interim while we went on a recruiting search. And that individual had some concerns with the fact that we were telling him he was going to have to comply with state law. And so he ultimately decided to leave the organization on his own accord. And then we had two other departures of what's being characterized inaccurately in one case based on the position. So I would just tell you that, you know, I'm happy to have conversations with you on kind of, you know, the big ticket items that are trying to maybe be clickbait rather than actually attempting to understand an organization.
Thank you. We don't have as long today as we normally do, so I'm going to get the other folks that I have listed, and then we'll come back. Representative Skidmore, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director. I understand that you've done a lot of things, and you've got a lot of progress made, but I do want to kind of focus a little bit more on the unemployment situation and the breach, and sort of kind of factor that or weave that into a proactive approach that you might take or your agency might take in terms of Deloitte, right? So it was disturbing to a lot of us that the state went ahead, the Agency for Healthcare Administration went ahead and hired Deloitte after the tragic failure of our unemployment system. I'm sure you've made tons of progress on top of that failure. Then we had the security breach. We still have, I'm sure many members can relate to how many people are still calling us with their concerns about not being able to get into unemployment. It's the pall over all of our offices of trying to help our constituents with that. And I have a really large concern as we move forward with the Deloitte contract with Medicaid, that we are just setting ourselves up for another moment like that. So is there something that your agency is doing proactively in terms of that? And is there true cooperation and communication with the department and your agency on the unemployment side to resolve their issues?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Great question. I think there's two parts to it. If you'll allow me. One is what we're doing, one is what we can't do. And so what I would stress to you, I'm gonna start with kind of what our job is and what our job isn't as designated in policy. The legislature has historically taken a look that our role should be on the project oversight side for projects that exceed a certain threshold. Meaning, if a technology project is in excess of $10 million, then we are statutorily required to provide oversight. That does not mean we're involved in the procurement process. That does not mean we have a seat at the table to do any of the design. That does not mean we do anything until, right, effectively, a project gets appropriated and an agency spends, and then this onboarding process of, okay, well, you know, we're agency X and we have this big project and you're supposed to give us oversight, so how's that gonna work? So I want just everybody to understand, I'll give you another example that the two connect has obviously been kind of a year-long series of questions for us. Apple's announcement. When I was in this body, we approached Apple about getting in the identity space to look at a digital wallet. And the fact that Florida's not at the table for the launch is something that personally is frustrating. It's also something that a lot of my former colleagues thought I could control, and I can't. That's a highway safety motor vehicles thing. And so
I want to make sure I explain kind of the lanes or the process that we're in pursuant to the policy that the legislature sets, because we don't have the ability to walk in, knock on the door, and say, show me your infrastructure, let us get to the bottom of what's happening. The most we have in the way of authority is quite frankly, perceived to show up and say, hey, there's an issue here. A lot of times we're notifying the agency of, hey, we found suspicious activity over here. Can we dive into it with you so that we can get on the front end? But we're dependent on their permission for that to happen. Now, with economic opportunity specifically, as I alluded to, they have been an agency, certainly Director Eagle, as somebody that I served with in this body, and somebody I've always known to stick to his word and be there for the right reasons and want to dive in, is a fantastic partner as an executive parallel. Edwin and their team try really hard to work together with us. The thing that I would tell you we're doing proactively is, and I'm going to take you back to the enterprise architecture. If you were to pull up the document, there's the rule itself. It's kind of like the legalese, for lack of a better term, that would go in the administrative code. But it then incorporates a document, and it also incorporates a form for the agencies to actually participate with the enterprise architecture. What we have proposed is that any new technology project in excess of $100,000 document these deliverables. And so whether it was Deloitte or any other vendor, doesn't matter who it is, the vendor would be responsible if the agency does procurement the way that we intend to actually document that all of those deliverables are in place for any project over $100,000. Interestingly enough, when we had the workshop, there were a handful of agencies, most of them cabinet agencies, that objected significantly that the threshold was too low. Our team, and I'll just say myself personally, believe that if you're going to spend $100,000 of taxpayer money on a technology asset, you ought to be able to walk through a pretty simple set of domains to document deliverables, even if you just make the vendor responsible for delivering it. And so while that might not be the answer proactively on Connect, because that is a retrospective thing that we, you know, we have the authority you've given us, we are working in every way we can to support them. What we are doing proactively is maximizing every resource to, at a minimum, do everything we can to prevent another one. Because I will tell you that as we dive into the procurement, I'll close on this, because we could spend hours going through it, right? Without sounding like I'm taking up for that vendor or any other vendor, one of the things that's been really, really striking about my first year is that we often as a state can't even explain what we're trying to buy for whom and why. We've found language in procurements that's 15 years old. We've done reviews for agencies that have asked us to say, hey, we're putting this procurement on the street, can you look at it? And our team has huddled back up after we break out, everybody takes a look and do a little stand up and say, hey, what are thoughts? And we've said, look, I don't even know what they're trying to buy. Or the vendor could give them anything and we're not gonna be able to hold them accountable because like these words mean nothing. And so I'm just a big believer that whether it's on the security space or the operations space, it all starts at the beginning. And if you'll do the design work on the front end to understand who the consumer is, why they need it, what they need out of it, those basic curiosity questions that lead good design that we can actually mitigate moving forward. But I don't want to leave you or anybody else with the impression that we have the authority to go out throughout the enterprise and just needle our nose into everything or control everything that's happening in the technology space, nor am I suggesting we should, because until we can get through the budgetary elements necessary, when I talk about where those FTEs are and where the appropriations are, you know, there's a reason that, to go back to Representative Smith's question, some of those vacancies I can't hire because they're in the wrong bucket. They're in the wrong budget entity, and so we legitimately can't hire them. We've got to do the reformation work to right-size there as part of this year's budget process so that we can go, because on paper, Representative Smith's question is a very fair one. You know, you're saying you have challenges. Why aren't you hiring them? We would love to. We can't. And so getting through that work is necessary, which is why I say if we were to be responsible for everything tomorrow, I think I'd be in here getting a different kind of spanking for all the things that you expect us to do, giving us the authority to do, and then not having the resources to do.
Great answers there. I do want to provide just a little bit further context there. We last year we did hear Representative Mariano's bill, House Bill 1079. So while it doesn't fix some of the current problems, it puts a suspended vendor list together. So So there are some mechanisms in place. The other thing I would say there is if anyone's interested in filing a bill or looking at legislation to potentially provide some more authority so that CIO's grants office can actually implement some more of this, that's certainly something that I'm interested in, even if it's limited to certain agencies, to try to drive the ball down the field a little bit further and faster. Representative Henson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had some specific questions that all of the other questions and answers have kind of changed my perspective. I like the begin with the end in mind. I've already operated that way, and that's a good way to start. With your struggles in transitioning, transforming, repositioning, I see where you're headed with this, and hope I'm using the right language. But cybersecurity is especially important to all of us. And I wonder right now, while you're doing these things, is there some kind of firewall, alert system, SOS, tornado siren? How do we know if we are having a breach at the moment? That's my first question. And my second question is, with a $105 billion budget, why can't we pay people what they deserve to move to Tallahassee? Give us the kind of talent we deserve and do what you need them to do to build the kind of system that will protect us.
You recognize.
Thank you. It's a fantastic, two great questions. I'm going to start with the last one and remind me if I forget the first one on the breach, if you don't mind. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. You know, we're looking at everything. One of the reasons I leaned in early on the tour service model was that it becomes relatively easy to align city, state, academic, private partner, mutual wins around a pipeline as long as I'm willing to lean into the churn, right? So just to be clear, like, I do expect a lot of turnover in this organization from a subset of people as we move. I think one thing that we're trying to figure out is what kind of policy would actually facilitate a tour service like employee. That's been an interesting thing to kind of shift to the HR side of government and say, is this an OPS worker? Is this an FTE? Is this a stat? Like, how do you actually find an HR classification for that? I expect us to have a very healthy churn of tour service-like people. We've had some really big successes already with some tour service folks. The challenge, of course, is where we have the constraints to hire, it becomes difficult to build the bench of kind of next person up. So that's one thing. One thing I've been diving into is the Surgeon General model, right? Trying to understand that if the Surgeon General, as one example of an employee that is working for the state but also has employee sharing agreements with the university space. I think there's a lot of things we can do to give state university students or college students access to an amazing scholar opportunity to come work for us for course credit even. There's all sorts of things I think we could do in that space. We're trying to be as creative as we can within the constraints we have. Obviously, the legislature has pay bands, and so each position has a pay band on it, which is the minimum and the maximum that we can pay for that role. And so I think there's some collaborative stuff we could explore. To the second question, or what was your first, we sound a bugle, jokes aside, to give you kind of how that normally works. Typically, our team discovers suspicious activity through tools we run. Those tools are highly manual. And fortunately, we have a really, really talented team. Small, but really talented. Those folks then go through a process of alerting the ISM, the information security manager, and the CIO to say, hey, we've found some things that look suspicious. Can we come work with you? And now you're at a decision tree. They either let us in or they choose not to let us in. And I think the two pathways you have in that situation is maybe best described as self-preservation is a heck of a drug. Because if I'm responsible for security and somebody else shows up and says, I think you have a breach, you have people that say, well, gosh, if I just close my doors and don't let them access anything, they're not going to be able to document the breach and nobody will ever find out about it until it shows up on the front page of the paper, right? Until it gets big enough. And to be clear, that was not the situation at DEO before anybody jumps to assumptions. I just mean in that situation, right, like something makes news, and now all of a sudden they have to let us in. I think that's where I get to us establishing trust. I don't want to be knocking with warrants telling people, open up. I want them to see our team as a resource that can help them navigate the breach. And I think we've done a lot of great work to begin the cultural change this year. I think we have a ton of work left to do. But I would tell you that's kind of where the decision tree goes. And then if we're able to get in, we start getting to documenting suspicious activity. And then after we've documented suspicious activity, we start to work on a remediation plan and recommendations for them. Maybe the last thing I'd say to answer that question is, I think if we were to poll this panel, most of you remember what Colonial Pipeline was. I don't think many of you either know or remember what SolarWinds is. SolarWinds maintains as the most significant cybersecurity event that this state has ever seen, far larger than Colonial. It just didn't result in people putting gas in plastic bags and trash cans in the back of a truck and giving you a physical or tangible imagery of what happened. The reality is, at some point, we have to make the assessment of, is the infrastructure safe enough? Because there's really no way to be able to say that we have completely cleaned the infrastructure in some situations without burning it to the ground and starting over. And so we have to navigate within the resources to be able to put a plan in place for the agencies to say, hey, look, let's continue monitoring. We've isolated where we know that the threat existed. And let's continue monitoring, but we work very collaboratively to give them a plan. It just starts with agency buy-in, which starts with our ability to earn their buy-in and their trust.
Representative Guillermo Smith, you're recognized for another question if you still have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you again, Mr. Grant. I know we served together, so I'm hoping you can keep your answer short. I have a couple questions. The first one, I guess I need a short answer on, is if you can address exactly how many vacancies you have in your department, because you challenged some of the reporting that we've seen on what the vacancies are. So if I can just get a quick answer on what those, how many vacancies you have in your department. And then generally, of course, this will take longer to respond. It just seems like the office is struggling. We've seen more breaches. Obviously, we have a lot of vacancies. Like you, I think that cybersecurity is very, very, very important. And we, as lawmakers, I feel like should prioritize it. You've mentioned that maybe the Surgeon General's model might be good, but you know, with him spending half of his job at a university, we didn't hear from him for almost a year during the pandemic. I didn't hear from him even after I sued him, so that's something separate. But my question is, do we just need more money to recruit people into these positions? Texas, in the Tampa Bay Times reporting, spent over $100 million for their equivalent of their office, and they spent almost $1 billion to beef up specifically the cybersecurity. So you know what it's like as a former legislator. You see agency heads come in and they're very conservative with their ask. They don't ask for what they actually need, even though they know that that's what will get the job done. Do we just need more money?
Recognized.
Thank you. So the short answer is there's not a short answer to the first, but I'll take you back to the slide. Because some of what would be considered a vacancy isn't something we can fill. So we have 185 FTEs between the two budget entities. The reason I gave you the slide was to clarify that there are two distinct budget entities that make up the Florida Digital Service. You have some vacancies that cannot currently be filled. So if you're considering those a vacancy, that's a different answer. You have FTEs in one bucket, but not the rate in the other bucket. So I don't mean to dodge the question. I can tell you that there's 185 FTE in the organization this year. I can tell you there's about 135 or 36 right now that are filled, but I can tell you that the existing rate which you need to hire is in the wrong budget entity compared to some of the vacant positions.
Okay.
And so it's a structural question on that front. And so if you just took kind of a, and I know you don't, which is why I appreciate the dialogue, if you took a very lazy and sloppy approach to just looking at something on paper without asking why, then you would be left with the presumption that we have the ability to go hire a bunch of people. But you have to have rate, you have to have salary, and you have to have FTE all aligned in the right budget entity to be able to hire. And currently, rate, which is controlled at a department level, So I don't have the ability, as long as I sit inside DMS, I don't have the ability to move rate anywhere that it doesn't come to me. And so if the rate is not sitting in the right budget entity, I can't hire. So there's a longer answer, but that's the shortest I can give you of it. It is much more complicated, even though it's kind of straightforward, of can you get FTE, salary and benefit, and rate aligned in the right budget entity? Because if you have a vacant position in one budget entity, but the cash in the other, you can't hire. Or the rate in the other, you can't hire. To your second question, it's not just a matter of money. While I do think that money like technology scales things, it's a policy and governance and structural thing. One of the things I learned in my very first company was commission plans will always give you what they ask for. If they ask for perverse behavior, you will get perverse behavior. If they ask for the right kind of behavior that helps build the organization, you will get it. So do I think that resources would help? Absolutely. Do I think that money would help us scale? Absolutely. But do I think that money is the cure? Not at all. The first thing that is a cure is getting the right structure and governance that money can then scale.
Representative Roth, do you still have a question? You recognize for
a question? Yes, sir, Chair. And as an employer, I'm very interested in this conversation you're having, and thank you for being so open and transparent about it and giving us a lot of examples. The thought occurs as an employer, wouldn't it be nice that you have a state government where there's fluidity, where you're saying that, oh, I can't do this and I can't do that because of where the rate is and the buckets and all that. Is there some, this is a comfort question, I'm looking for comfort. Is there some ability as the state of Florida to say, you've been working in this department for 20 years and you no longer want to work in this department, are you on the list to be able to get hired from another department? Is that something that is just normal or needs to be done to allow employees, particularly in a situation where you're, like you're saying, you're having difficulty hiring new employees, to be able to move them around? Is there some process for doing that?
Mr. Chair?
You're recognized.
So I will tell you this. One of the things that I've told our team is that if we can establish a center of excellence, which is very clearly what we're going to be aiming for, right? You've seen very authoritarian state technology offices, and then you've seen anarchy throughout the enterprise. I think the middle of that is a center of excellence that creates standards, governance, and as part of that, there is absolutely the ability for me to hire from within or transfer. A lot of that is oftentimes picking up the phone and calling. We just hired a chief of service experience a little while ago, and that was calling another agency to say, hey, I'd like to explore bringing this person on board. Is that something that's going to disrupt your operation? And so it's sometimes the teamwork of collaborating with their current employer to say, hey, would this be disruptive, or how long of a transition period do you need? My hope is that we would be bringing, that the digital service would be hiring and recruiting talent that would actually come into the digital service and then perhaps be the bench for agency CIOs. We have a lot of agency CIOs that will retire over the next few years because they'll hit 30 years. How we create a bench to try and continually increase the outputs and the talent and the collaboration of the team is something we've got to work on. So there's not really a restriction there from an HR perspective as far as somebody moving from here to there. But I can give you an example to maybe tether the questions. If the wrong person gets, so we've had probably, probably seven folks who have taken at least twice their salary with us to go to the private sector. In the current posture, if they're in the wrong budget entity, we can't actually replace them. So when we get a notification that somebody's going to the private sector, it's kind of like, man, I hope they're in the right budget entity. Or if I want to move somebody from budget entity over here to the office, from the state data center to the office of the state CIO, I'm actually shooting myself in the foot a little bit because I can't refill the state data center vacancy. And so I have to then explain to that employee, look, I know you'd like to be in the security space. I know you'd like to be in the infrastructure space. Just bear with me till we get through next session, because if I pull you out of here and put you over here, I can't backfill and get us additional resources. If I actually have a vacancy I can fill, I need to bring additional manpower or womanpower to help fix that.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. So thank you. You answered kind of half the question. I was more interested in the other half from the perspective of the employees, the state employees that maybe want to move. Maybe they're, you know, they're I don't know, operationally challenged or whatever, and they decide, you know what, I think I want to move to a different department. I want to do that. There's obviously, I'm asking for, it's like, this is a feel-good question. I'm kind of asking, is there that easy availability that Florida Department of Agriculture Conservation Services knows that you have an employee that wants to work somewhere else? Is there that transparency? And, you know, I'm asking from an employee standpoint.
You're recognized.
I'd love to give you comfort, but I'd be lying to you. If somebody wants to transfer within a domain I control, right? So those five teams I put up there, sure, we can have those conversations inside. I think the only thing that I'm aware of, there may be something, but the only thing I'm aware of that a Department of Ag employee would find out we're looking for something is if a job was posted. There's no way for, and I don't think it would, I don't know that it's kind of bureaucracy's culture for somebody in kind of a safe job to raise their hand and say, I'm looking for a new job. And so sometimes finding those folks are quite frankly through a friend of a friend. More than half of the hires we've made have actually been by people who work for us saying, hey, I've got a great friend over there who's ready to make a move. Are we interested in talking to them? And so we very much want a culture where our people are recruiting good people to come in. In year one, we've been successful in that arena, but there's not anything formal other than kind of word of mouth that I'm aware of.
Thank you. Representative McClure, do you still have a question? You're recognized for a question if you do.
Thank you, Chair, and I cannot believe I'm going to ask you a question because I know it's going to go on and on and on forever. But, Mr. Grant, so two things that have kind of stuck out to me, and I think following Representative Guillermo Smith, I'm trying to understand, you know, we got to get everything in the right buckets. It's got to all be aligned, and then if we do that, you know, we've won the lottery ticket, now we can go hire someone, which just seems to be a ridiculous way to do things coming from a business background. So maybe very quickly, if you can explain, how can we solve for that from our side of the table? How can we help you? Because, I mean, I think I'd lose my absolute mind if that was how I had to conduct myself in your position. And then secondly, can you walk me through putting aside the vacancies where everything doesn't, the verticals don't all align, like, so put those off to the side. How many positions are vacant where all the verticals do align, or are there any, or is it de minimis in nature?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Two questions, and I think you specifically will appreciate this. This last year has taught me restraint more than any other exercise in my life. You heard it right. It is a challenge. I think the way I think there's a couple things. We had some real challenges last year, given that the deputy chief of staff at DMS, who had legislature and comms, was very deservedly promoted to be the chief of staff at ACCA. And to describe Cody's loss in the midst of session as significant would be an understatement. And so we had to navigate the budget process really through an agency. I think maybe one thing that might not be known is for legislative affairs, budget, finance, comms, all of those things, DMS is where we have that stuff. So if DMS doesn't have a legislative affairs director, that's the same thing as me not having a legislative affairs director. And so going through the budget conference with some challenges, I think, in communication expectation, led to something I've never seen before, where all parties thought that they were helping us, from the plaza level to the fourth floor, everywhere thought they were helping us. And it wasn't until we, in July, got access to some workbooks and some documents that we were able to kind of unbundle what had actually happened in the budget process that was causing some of the internal limitations we were experiencing. So I think the shortest answer is we get to next, through this session. Because I think it's the appropriations process, that's where FTEs, that's where rate, that's where positions. I do think the good news, if you look at, and part of the reason I give the transition from bucket A to bucket B and then to the future, as we outsource the state data center, that is a group of dollars and FTEs that would, there's no subtle tweaks to the digital service this session, right? There's a fundamental question of what should the digital service be? Am I working myself out of a job to be the last guy to shut the lights off? Or are we structuring it up to make sure that it kind of accomplishes what I think everybody's intended purposes, and we're prepared to do anything on either end or in between. The latter question, how many vacancies? They're largely de minimis. It's quite frankly more a bucket of money than anything, because in order to navigate the budgetary constraints, we put a series of positions zeroed out in kind of a parking lot to ensure that we do not in any scenario get into the red. So it's really an exercise of making sure we don't get into the red, which then becomes an exercise of what talent can we actually get. To be clear, we're focused on cybersecurity and project oversight. This body and the legislature has made clear in proviso that those are to be the priorities. So things we hire will either be in those two buckets or in the policy world because of the rulemaking and budgetary challenges. I've been really, really fortunate to have a couple hires. Two are with us. Three, we do, to give assurances. Tyler Russell has joined the agency as a legislative affairs and deputy chief of staff. I'm not good. I didn't want to get in trouble. But that's a grand slam, right? So I don't think you will see a repeat of last session, and you will see the four of us at every conference offer, because what happened last year won't happen again this year from the best of intentions leading us in a place where it's just a constant puzzle of how to get the budget, the rate, and the FTE all aligned to the right place to be able to make the hires and not go into the red.
All right. Thank you. So just for context for everybody, we have about 10 minutes left. So we'll continue to entertain questions, but just so you know, as far as when you ask the question and when the questions are answered, we've got about 10 minutes left to go. Representative Henson, do you still have a question? So you are recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is actually similar to his, but I don't want your long answer. I actually need to understand your answer. How can we help you? And the answer should be, I need A, B, and C. And until I can understand that, I don't know how to help you.
Yes, ma'am, and Mr. Chair.
Recognize.
I need to get alignment of the FTEs, which the legislature, through the budgetary process, the full-time equivalents or the full-time employees. I need the FTEs, I need the rate, which is appropriated through the budgetary conference, and I need the salary and benefits to be in the right place to carry out the mission. So if maybe I can break it down this way. The full-time equivalent is just the little box on paper that says position number, right? It's the desk for somebody to sit at, let's say. The salary and benefits is the cash in the bank account. And then the rate is the legislative permission to spend the cash. So just because I have the cash doesn't mean I can spend it. I need to have a desk, I need to have the cash, and I need to have the permission to spend the cash aligned to the mission that the legislature wants us to carry out. Thank you for the chance to clarify.
Ranking Member Chambliss, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is that a legislative solution? Like, do we need to create legislation that gives you permission to spend the money that you need to spend? And I have a follow-up.
You're recognized.
You do it every year in the GAA. It's called rate. And so it's appropriated to the agencies. The agency at an agency level has some discretion. Because I sit inside of an agency, I get the rate that I'm given.
You have a follow-up? You're recognized for a follow-up?
And so this is more, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this is more of waiting until that rate is implemented?
Yes, sir.
And so that...
You're recognized for one follow-up.
And so the timetable is based on when that rate will be implemented and when will that rate be implemented?
You're recognized.
So I think there's two components, right? So agencies have discretion, and so I don't want to speak on behalf of anybody else or... give representations that I can't deliver on. But absent that, rate is actually appropriated each year in the budget. And so the timetable for that would be the legislative appropriation this upcoming year, and then the signature of the budget, obviously.
It sounds like we have some work to do on that. I know back when you were in the legislature, there was a change for the Agency of State Technology, and you know, went inside of DMS, and now you're leading it there. It sounds like maybe you need some more authority, similar to an agency head. If you're going to stay inside of an agency, you need some more flexibility there. That's one of my takeaways, at least. Representative Skidmore, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm concerned about the opportunities where your agency discovers suspicious activity and needs permission to investigate it further. And if if there was a legislative packet that was presented that kind of covered all your areas that need to be covered, and you and your agency was given some kind of authority that upon the discovery of suspicious activity, you had some authority to investigate, do you actually have the capacity to do that based on your constraints? And as a kind of an overall question, will you be presenting someone with legislative fixes that, you know, we're all trying to wrap our heads around everything that you're very well aware of. But, you know, typically we look to the agency heads to give us the legislation that fixes their problems.
3 minutes, you're recognized.
So caveat that I knew I was going inside an agency when I took the appointment. I think there's strengths in that model in the sense that I don't have to run all of the back office and those kind of things. So I was aware I was going inside an agency when I got here. I don't want to in any way cast a spur. DMS has a lot to do, and we are just one component. So I don't want anybody to leave with the takeaway that that's, you know, I got blindsided by that per se. High level, yes, we will once we can draw down the budget amendment, because through the $30 million that's appropriated, just to be clear, that's not $30 million we're going to spend internally on us. That's money we spend on agencies. Some of it will be centralized, like that SOC is a kind of a hub to be a central thing that serves all agencies. What we have done in all of our program design on that, and I've told the team, SaaS or software as a service is an item of last resort. Because we need managed services. We need people who can participate and work with us. Part of that $30 million actually includes threat assessment, threat intel, and then vulnerability management. So as soon as we can get the clarification, the final kind of clarification to get that budget amendment queued up and to y'all, we will immediately begin the procurement process to be able to do that. So I think by next session, the answer to your question is yes.
All right. I don't think we'll have time for an answer to another question or another question. I mean, honestly. And so what I do want to do is go ahead and bring the meeting to a close here. What I would recommend to any members that still have questions, please still feel free to submit those questions to CIO Grant or to my office, and we'll try to do our best to make sure that we can get answers for you there, because as we heard today, is a lot of questions, good, robust discussion. I think there are some things to take away from this to go work on, both as a committee and as legislators who serve on other committees who do these appropriations and whatnot. So I want to thank you, CIO Grant, for coming in, giving us the great presentation. Really appreciate the work that you're doing. I think you made a great hire. Tyler is an amazing person. You're lucky to have him. The state's lucky to have him. And with that, this will conclude our committee agenda. Once we adjourn, please remember to exit promptly so the sergeant can prepare the room. Seeing no further business before the committee, Representative Roth moves that we rise without objection. Meeting's adjourned.